Good evening. You're listening to Tales of Valor and Sorcery, the only occasional podcast about D&D that's recorded in a minivan with a sleeping toddler in the back seat. I'm your host, Eric Jensen. Unfortunately, I missed January entirely. Christmas came and went, New Year's came and went, and all of January slid underneath the carpet like a parking ticket that should have been paid. Here we are in February, nearly on Valentine's Day, and I'm finally throwing together all the things I should have put together last month. This is becoming a systemic problem. Anyway, on tonight's episode, we're going to talk about reviews. I actually have a couple to present. I'll present a short review of Three Sad Wizards by Weird Opera, which is an OSR product that I had the privilege to run last year in my Trident Bay campaign. And then we'll fast forward back to recent weeks to talk about the adventure Advent of the Avalanche Lords for Dungeon Crawl Classics, which I adapted to 5e and ran on my birthday. So we'll talk about that whole shindig and trying to get the D&D birthday party to blossom overnight into an actual home game. So sit back and relax. It's double review time on Tales of Valor and Sorcery. The first review I have for you tonight is of a product called Three Sad Wizards. It's released by a group called Weird Opera. It was a fun adventure. I picked it up. I guess I got it print on demand. And I had it sitting on my shelf for a little bit, but I knew instantly I wanted to use it just because it was so different from a lot of the other products that I had picked up around then. Three Sad Wizards presents basically... The adventure is centered around the eponymous wizards, who are, of course, depressed. And I used it in my game as it seems to be intended to be used, which is that the PCs encounter these three sad wizards who each have a problem, and then they go and help with all three of those problems in sequence. But one of the things that I really liked about the adventure is that you don't have to use it that way. If you sort of ignore that setup, what you're presented with is three wizard residences that you can drop in, you know, to use whenever. They're fairly small. And they're themed. So each wizard in the adventure has a thing they're into. One's into birds, one's into plants, and one's into, you know, bugs and spiders and things like that. So each of their small residences is kind of a little dungeon-type setup that is then themed around that interest that the wizard has. And this is kind of fun because, you know, you can use it to drop in somewhere. Or once the PCs get to any of these places and they realize there's a theme, they're going to start acting as though there's a theme. I know that when my group from my Trident Bay campaign showed up at the plant wizard's house, they very quickly realized everything was plants. And so Big Derek, the impetuous, the fighter, is like, yeah, let's just burn everything. So they just sort of systematically, in an old-school arson hobo kind of way, work their way through the reasonably linear residence, and anything that looked vaguely like a plant, they burned. So in that case, maybe they missed out on some opportunities, but they were playing it safe. One of the reasons that I like this adventure is that the three residences set up this resonating parallel kind of thing, right? So for each one, you're like, okay, it's the residence, it's got a theme, let's go through it and deal with the issue. But for each one, the issues are a little different, right? It's not, oh no, the plants are out of control this one, and oh no, the birds are out of control this one, and oh no, the spiders are out of control the third, right? Each one is subtly different, so the PCs are forced to deal with things in a slightly different way. There are NPCs, primarily the three wizards and the object of their affection in town at the tea house, but there are others to deal with, including one of the wizard's apprentices, sort of. I'm not going to spoil the adventure to cover exactly what's going on with that apprentice, but it's interesting. And suffice to say, if you've read the adventure, my players didn't find the thing they ought to have found that was related to the apprentice. If you've read the adventure, you know what I'm talking about. Another interesting NPC is one who has taken over one of the wizard's residences. And interestingly, my players elected to just let that be. They cut a deal with the interloper and then went back to the tea house to tell that wizard, yeah, it's not your house anymore. So you know, while the presumed method to solve the adventure is to, you know, deal with the problem at each one, players being players, they may not always do that. Now, everything in Three Sad Wizards is statted out in sort of a labyrinth lordy way, so that's easy to translate into whatever game you're playing. As far as power levels, I mean, it's really aimed, I don't think it even says all that explicitly, it's aimed fairly low. I wouldn't call it a first level type adventure. I mean, maybe you could, depending on the pace at which you went through it and how careful your players are. But it's definitely low-ish, right? You don't need to throw six level characters at this adventure. This is something, you know, for just a small group. I'm trying to think which PCs I had when we ran it. I guess it was just the original three. So at the time, I had second level going into third level characters. That sounds about right. And they were fine. You know, it's not the sort of adventure where I felt that at any point they were in super great peril, right? There were no close TPKs like we had with the next adventure we'll review next episode. But, you know, there were parts where if they had been uncautious, reckless, or maybe not had a cleric around, they would have had some issues. But the interest in the adventure is less the combat danger and more just the situational stuff that's going on, engaging with the themes and the NPCs. It's not super trap heavy, but it's not necessarily super combat heavy either. There's stuff here and there, but there's a strong exploratory component. Now, one thing, interestingly, that my players didn't do, despite being very experienced players of D&D in general, is that when recruited by these wizards to save their own residences, at no point did they say, "Hey, wizard, here's a napkin, sketch me your house. Or tell me what kind of wacky wizard crap you have going on in your house so I don't stumble through a portal to hell, and so that I know where your gremlin rookery is," or whatever, right? They didn't ask for any of that stuff. They just kind of said, "All right, we'll go over there and poke around." So be ready if you have a player group of different mind to have to provide those things ahead of time. And obviously you can just sketch that out as needs be. And if anything is incorrect, well, perhaps that could just be blamed on how sad the wizards are. So when my PCs were finished with this adventure, and it ended up taking them really a session and a half, because we were playing kind of shorter sessions at that point in the campaign, I think you could, if you're the sort of group that plays fairly long sessions, you could probably do all three wizard houses in one session, right? Especially if you're the charging forward type and they don't waste a whole lot of time poking around with things. But so it was about a session and a half, and then they spent some more NPC time with the wizards. And in our case, the whole reason that they went to the town where these three wizards live, which is kind of weird, right? I mean, most of our fantasy worlds don't assume that three mid-level wizards, are going to be living in the same really small village, but whatever. So we learned something about, you know, the campaign world by the fact that this is a thing that occurs, right? They had gone to this village called Tea Leaf to meet these wizards, because everybody knew three wizards lived in this town, because they had this magical item that they needed looked at. And if you'll recall from a previous episode, this group had secured a magical black pearl from the DCC adventure, Tower of the Black Pearl. So they're toting this thing around, and obviously they want to get it identified, you know, and get some backstory on it. So I fed them a line that, you know, hey, there's this town over here that's got, everybody knows, like, three wizards live there. Maybe that's a place to start. And it was close enough to them on the map, conveniently, that that was where they wanted to go for the next adventure. So they spent session and a half-ish dealing with that before moving on to the next thing. But bottom line is, Three Sad Wizards from Weird Opera, solid OSR-type adventure if you're playing Labyrinth Lord, Swords and Wizardry, BX, 5e, whatever you want to convert it to. It's pretty easy to convert. Relatively strong theming on three small locations. So it's definitely worth picking up to put in your quiver, as it were. It will provide you, you know, the locations are statted and they're written out. It's not a location generator, but it's not a huge product either. You can just kind of keep it in your bag, or say the next time I need a wizard house, you know, that isn't a ridiculous extra planar tower, there, you just pull out a wizard house and there you go. So, solid recommendation of Three Sad Wizards. I'd like to offer a quick word about convention attendance. You know, now that we're past the first of the year, the holidays, and people are starting to, project where they're going to be through the summer, everybody's talking about con attendance. Where are you going to go? What cons are you going to plan? That's great. You should absolutely be planning where you're going to go. One thing that we always tend to see this time of year, and as we go into the spring, that baffles me, and here I may be courting some controversy or sounding like a jerk, it baffles me to see people on social media essentially begging for other people to fund their trips to Gen Con. I just don't get it. I mean, if you're some kind of content creator, which is not a phrase I love, if you're a publisher, a podcast, or whatever, or you've got a Patreon, and you are collecting money via other means and stating explicitly, hey, some of this is going to go towards getting us to Gen Con, great, that's fine. What I don't think I'll ever be able to wrap my head around is people who just come out and say it. Hey, here's a GoFundMe to get me to Gen Con. I totally need and deserve to go to Gen Con. Why don't you pay for it? I'm not wired that way. We go on vacation when we can afford to go on vacation in our household. And it's always been that way. And there have been many years we didn't go on vacation and years we didn't go to cons. So the idea that someone, I hate using the E word, feels so entitled as to ask for, I don't get it. But you know what? I don't get the GoFundMe to pay my rent thing either. So maybe I'm just old. I'll totally cop to that. Anyway, start looking at your con attendance now for this season and going into the fall and budget. Go to cons. That's great. But plan it out. Don't expect a miracle to send you to the convention that you have your heart set on. That said, the other thing that vexes me, I am sorely vexed, about people getting excited about cons is that everybody's talking about the big cons. Everybody talks about Gen Con, and people talk about Origins to a lesser extent. I am not of the opinion that the big con is necessarily the best way to spend your money. This is, again, old man giving advice here. You might get more bang for your buck out of a small local con, or several of them spaced throughout the year. To me, I mean, I've been to Gen Con. It was okay. It was too big for me. And I've been saying that since I went. I think if your goal is playtime, actual playing of RPGs, not walking around looking dazzled and spending too much money on food and all this kind of stuff, bang for your buck, if you're looking to play, is smaller regional cons. That's why sometimes out on Twitter I will complain about this and then throw up the hashtag playlocal, right? And the reason is, I see my dollars go back into my local community. I'm not talking about dollars spent on, you know, the games you buy from people all over the world. That's great. But the convention center, the vendors, the food, I'd rather keep that a little local because then at least I know where it's going. And in a smaller con, I feel like you see people year after year and you build relationships. Whereas with Gen Con, I can state categorically, Gen Con doesn't know who I am and doesn't care who I am. And why would they? I mean, is it 70,000 people, was it last time? So it's a different scope. It's a totally different thing. For my money, I would rather go to 4 or 5 little cons, ranging up into the medium cons, which are starting to be very popular when we talk about Gary Con's getting big, Game Hole is getting large. Those are definitely in the medium zone, as far as I'm concerned. More bang for your buck going to local cons. I don't know. Maybe it's because I used to run a small local con, and I still prefer the small ones that I can see people that I know, and, you know, it's easy to get pickup games and all that. But that's just where I am on that. At the very least, I'm not going to ask you to try to send me to Gen Con. That said, if you're a publisher and you think I could add value, I'll take your money. Right? I'll stand in front of the flag and take your money all damn day. But I'm not going to go begging my people, my non-patrons. I don't know. The idea of me having a Patreon is hysterical. I don't, and I won't. If I could actually get product out the door, I would. But other stuff comes first. That's why I'm only podcasting once a month. Anyway, let's move on back to reviews.
One of the downsides to recording an Anchorcast on your phone, which should be obvious to me but wasn't until a few minutes ago, is that you can receive a phone call in the middle of recording a segment. And by in the middle, I mean almost near the end. And that screwed everything up for me. So I'm trying this segment again. At the end of December, I had my 44th birthday, invited a bunch of people over to play D&D, and we were going to run the adventure Advent of the Avalanche Lords by Tim Callahan. It's a DCC holiday adventure. The cool thing about the get-together was that it was a combination of people that, you know, hadn't all played together before. Some I'd never played D&D with. So it was, you know, two guys that I've been playing with for 30 years, literally, you know, since 8th grade, which is the age my older boy is now. And that's kind of weird to think about. And then some people from work, sort of different work social groups, right? Overlapping, but not the same group. And who else? A friend's fiance, who I'd never played with before, but I knew played. I'm like, all right, get over here. Let's play. And then one of my nephews, who's in his, you know, mid-20s or whatever, mid to late 20s. So that was kind of neat to have all these different groups overlapping. And at first it was a little weird, you know, like that first time that you happen to go out and see both high school friends and college friends at the same time. You remember that? That was weird the first time. So, but we got it right into it. With that many players, we had some ground rules about crosstalk. It wasn't a big deal. So these seven PCs started out. I allowed the two gentlemen who had previously played in my Trident Bay campaign play their original characters. So they were fifth level. And then everybody else was either playing a third level pregen or a third level character that they had generated themselves. So they started out on the whole thing, seemed to be enjoying it. It was a good adventure. We had a good run, and we were able to get to what felt like the end, right? Anytime you're doing something that's framed as a one-shot, you want some kind of ending. I mean, I suppose you could end a one-shot on a cliffhanger, but I also had aspirations to this session being both self-contained, but also sort of a backdoor pilot to getting a home game going. And we'll talk more about how that's gone in the next episode. The adventure, Advent of the Avalanche Lords, is a holiday adventure. It's not as holiday-y as some of the other DCC ones that I looked at. You know, you don't have toy-making elves and stuff, but there is a Santa Claus analog that is part of it, this guy Father Frost. And then the overall plot line involves this trio of bad guys that are trying to, you know, steal Father Frost's power and destroy the elven town and all this kind of stuff. So we had a good time running it, and the players made it, you know, essentially to the end and did what they were supposed to do with, I don't think, no real casualties. But I afterward was thinking a lot about the villains of the piece. There are three villains. There's a sort of an ice-themed dude, and then there's a fire-themed witch-type character, and then there's also this like rival toy maker type warlocky character who can make like crazy dolls and stuff, right? And these three are the so-called Avalanche Lords who are teaming up to be the bad guys. Here's the thing. First things first, unlike, let's say, a second edition D&D adventure or something from the pages of Dungeon or maybe even certain DM's Guild products, this adventure did not give me a page of friggin' backstory on each villain. I was fine with that. I don't need a page of tragic backstory on my villains. I just need to know they're the villains. That said, though, the way the adventure was set up, and it was a little linear, and this is a complaint that we hear about some DCC adventures, but you know what? When you're running a one-shot, maybe you want something more linear, so I'm not going to complain about that tonight. Because of the way that the adventure was set up, those three villains are not encountered until what is essentially the final scene, final two scenes of the adventure. Right? This is the tragedy of having a big, bad, evil guy who never shows up until the end. And so, unlike in some adventures where we might have had one villain that was kind of cool but maybe wasted, here in Advent we had three. So, I was kind of talking about this on Twitter after the fact, and Tim Callahan, the author of the adventure, reached out to me and said, hey, you know, you're right. Like, there was more material in a previous, you know, less edited version of the adventure that dealt more with the villains and their more complex motivations and how to introduce them earlier and all this kind of stuff. Because what I had said in Twitter was like, man, obviously I knew they weren't coming till the end of the adventure, but if I really thought about the consequences of that as the way the adventure feels, I would have tried to use those villains earlier, right? If you're sliding this adventure into an existing campaign, you definitely want to introduce one or more of those villains several sessions before, right? You want that effect of, oh my God, it's, you know, Dr. Doom and Kang the Conqueror and Kingpin, or that would be a weird combination, are all teaming up and this is what we have to deal with, right? But the way Advent's written, you don't really get that because the first time you see them is at the end. And they're really kind of cool characters. Tim was saying that, you know, two of them are intended to be homages to Heat Miser and Snow Miser from The Year Without a Santa Claus. And I felt bad because I hadn't picked up on that. Now, don't get me wrong. It was obvious one was a nice dude and the other was, she was a you know, had fire powers. I got that. But I guess because, I don't know if it was the gender switch on the one or the fact that they weren't described as siblings or anything like that. And I just didn't get it. In my readings of the adventure, that didn't jump out at me. Maybe if the adventure had been structured in a way, and this isn't a complaint to Tim, but if the adventure had been structured in a way where you had to visit one and then visit the other, or they hated each other, but they were both still villains, I would have probably picked that up eventually, not eventually, but immediately, or eventually, depending on the day. So the lesson here is that if you're going to have meaningful villains, you want to use them as much as you can, right? I mean, what makes Dr. Doom awesome beyond his origins and power set and attitude and costume design is that he keeps coming back, right? If Dr. Doom showed up in an early issue of Fantastic Four and was Nova blasted in the face by Johnny Storm and never came back, nobody would talk about him today, right? Now, I'm not saying that you need to structure your sessions to give all your villains the narrative ability to always get away. I don't think we want that in a proper old school game, but it's nice when it works out that way. So when my players at this session fought the three, they ended up, Fire One was definitely killed. The wizard dude, I would say pretty definitely killed. The ice one, you know, when they defeated the ice one, we described it as, you know, shattering, like, you know, 1,000 icy pieces and releasing like a cold breeze or something. So one person at the table was like, oh, I wonder if he's actually dead. And frankly, that's all the door I need. The door is open for it to be plausible on an out of character level and maybe an in character level, for that guy to still be alive and show up again, which I'm totally going to do, because then he becomes the one who got away, even if he only got away once. And I want the players to have villains that they hate to motivate them moving forward. So anyway, circling back to the review portion, I think Advent's a solid choice among the DCC holiday adventure modules, or the Christmas winter ones anyway. I haven't read the Halloween ones yet. It's good. I think it works best if you tease it apart and incorporate chunks of it into your campaign months ahead of time, right? Otherwise, your application is to use it like I did, where it's the cheesy parts are sort of worn on the face of it, right? With no shame. You know, the snow globe gag, let it be a snow globe gag, right? Otherwise, you know, if you use that elvish town previously, it might have more meaning to the players, right? It's not just, here's the town we're in this week, we better save it, which people get tired of. And you probably, as a DM, get tired of. So, yeah, in all things, you want to be able to plan things out and tie those threads together, even if it's just a place that the PCs have heard of before, even if they've never been there. Same is true for villains. So, in conclusion, as I just sort of babble here, in conclusion, Advent of the Avalanche Lords, solid. I enjoyed it. It was a good session. I recommend it. I'm sure I'll get to the other DCC Christmassy type adventures next year. they're pretty seasonal. But yeah, so that session, basically immediately after we were done and everybody left, I hopped on that Facebook event where I had invited everybody in the first place and said, hey, do you guys want to do this again? And then we started to have that conversation. So where that led, we'll talk about on the next episode. But suffice it to say, we've had another session, and we got one coming up in a couple weeks. So it does look like I've got a home game rolling, which is great news. Otherwise, what's my basement for? So beyond the birthday party, what sort of gaming have I been doing lately? Well, as I may have mentioned before, I'm playing in a monthly Rappanathuk 5e game. My gnome rogue is still alive. And really, that's the only measure of success required for that game. I'm having a good time with it. It's monthly, which has its own drawbacks. I think in a little bit, after having, you know, enough sessions under my belt of that game and my own monthly game, I'm sure one day I will have deep thoughts on the efficacy of a monthly game. But of course, you'd rather have a monthly game than no game. I do still feel like the sweet spot is biweekly, or more often than that. I have no aspirations or expectations that I will ever get back to the let's play once to twice a week, like we did in high school. Those days aren't coming back until I retire. but I think as far as keeping stuff fresh in people's minds, biweekly might be preferable. We'll see. Anyway, other gaming. On the horizon, BFGCon, which is in Frederick, Maryland, is coming up in the middle of March. I'll be attending that, running a bunch of BX, and hopefully playing some DCC and some Astonishing... Is it Swordsmen and Sorcerers? Yeah, Astonishing Swordsmen and Sorcerers, not Sorcerers and Swordsmen. Anyway, some Ash... a couple sessions of that would be good to play. And anything else that comes up. So if you're in the area, in the Maryland, D.C., that corner of PA type area, check out bfgcon.com. We went last year, had a good time, coming back this year. What else is going on? That's about it. I haven't painted any minis lately. I did get some HeroClix in with my son. He got HeroClix for Christmas. The older boy. So we've had some sessions of that going on. But that stuff got swept to the side to make room for D&D. So I think we need to poke that again and bring those back out, because that's a fairly easy, you know, let's try to get in a game every weekend type event. And it's good for him to be involved and learn the rules and think about doing the whole two steps ahead type thing. That's it. The only other gaming planning I'm doing, I wouldn't say it's planning. Have you heard of this thing, Rollgate? It's not a scandal. It's not D&D Gate. Lord, no. What it is this new website. New. I say it's new to me. New website that supports sort of asynchronous... I don't want to call it play-by-post. It is play-by-post, but they're not structured that way. It looks more like a chat server, but it's somewhere in between that. And then it has apps to support that, die rolling, character sheets, all this kind of stuff, in and out of character, speech, you can thread things and separate the party and that kind of stuff. I haven't taken much of a look at it yet. I need to make time in my schedule to look at it, because the idea of using that to run a play-by-post, essentially, game of any pace is intriguing. I mean, I don't love play-by-post, but it's okay. It's better than nothing. And sometimes if you actually, you know, tune the game to the medium, you can get a completely different experience. I really shouldn't complain about play-by-post. It's kind of how I met my wife. So, hey, that turned out okay. yeah, that's what's going on with me gaming lately. I'm hoping to get more gaming in the next couple months as we get into the spring con season here. But as long as the home game keeps churning along and this monthly Rappanathuk thing goes, I can't complain. I'm getting two games in a month. And with my age and work schedule, that's pretty damn good. All right, that's the catch-up episode containing double review. I feel like I need noisemakers so I can be a shock jock. Yeah, check out Three Sad Wizards. Check out Advent of the Avalanche Lords. See if they're for you. Try and incorporate them into your campaign. We'll be back next time to talk more about what's going on in gaming for me. We'll talk about how my birthday party turned into a home game. We'll have... Maybe I'll do two more reviews. At that point, I will have finished running Doom of the Savage Kings for the home game. That's another classic DCC adventure. And I'll probably review the adventure that came next in the sequence in my last campaign after Three Sad Wizards, which was, if I remember correctly, Mort Zingersturm, the Mad Manticore of Prismatic Peak from Hydra Cooperative. So be on the lookout for next episode when we will review a Mad Manticore and a giant Viking beast here on Tales of Valor and Sorcery. You can always reach me through Anchor if you're using the app, or on Twitter at DaydreamTiger1, or you can find me through my old blog if you need SEO tips or Viagra. You can just read the comments. That's wampuscountry.blogspot.com. Have a great time gaming with your friends. Don't forget to play. And as always, imagine a better world. Welcome back to Tales of Valor and Sorcery, the occasional intermittent podcast about nothing at all. I'm Eric Jensen, your host. Today on the show, we're going to talk about a couple different things. First, we're going to talk about a dual review of the Dungeon Crawl Classics Super Classic Adventures, Sailors on the Starless Sea, which I ran a couple years ago as part of my campaign, and Doom of the Savage Kings, which I just finished running as part of sort of the same campaign. Both of those adventures are maybe the most well-run or most often-run DCC adventures, so I want to talk about them separately and together and sort of the roles they fill in the DCC canon. Also, today, hopefully, we'll get to talk about Faking Your Way Through Con Prep, which I'm in the middle of right now as I get ready to head off to BFG Con in Frederick, Maryland this coming weekend. So that's the show for today. Stick around for the two reviews and complaining about Con Prep tonight on Tales of Valor and Sorcery. When you start a conversation about Dungeon Crawl Classics adventures in print, inevitably people are going to talk about, in addition to several other early adventures that are pretty well known, two Harley Stroh adventures. One is Doom of the Savage Kings, and the other is Sailors on the Starless Sea. Now, both of these adventures have a special place in the heart of a lot of DCC fans because they were relatively early on in the releases for the DCC-specific modules. And they're pretty different adventures, despite being authored by the same skateboarding maniac. So Doom of the Savage Kings is actually, I think, significantly longer, contains more content, whereas Sailors on the Starless Sea is more con appropriate. And I think that's where a lot of people have exposed themselves to... Wow, really? Exposed themselves? A lot of people have been exposed to Sailors on the Starless Sea. I apologize, judges on the road crew, if people start showing up and dropping their pants at your adventures because I said that. So Sailors on the Starless Sea has been run a lot, a ton, maybe even to death. It's a lot of people's first exposure to DCC, not just the rule set, but sort of the genre assumptions that are pushed with it. It's fairly linear, and it's self-contained. These are good things when you're talking about a con game. There may be slightly less good things when you're talking about something to drop into your campaign. But as an adventure site, Sailors on the Starless Sea shines, because it's just a creepy old keep, with some chaotic goings-on down below. So you can plop it pretty much anywhere as necessary. You don't have to worry so much about the supplied reason for the adventure, which is, you know, it's for the funnel. It's you know, the forces of chaos have taken people from your village, blah, 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 this kind of stuff. You could put it anywhere. You know, most player groups worth their salt, if they see a creepy keep, they're going to go poke around. So that kind of takes care of itself. So I've played Sailors once and run it twice. I ran it a number of years ago in DCC, at a game store, and then I ran it more recently, I guess last year? Well, it's been over a year, for my Trident Bay 5e game. And of course, obviously these two different runnings went a little differently. For the DCC run, it was run as a funnel, right? So you've got all your peasants going in. And they're obviously
Harley hits the mark as far as supplying an adventure that is suitably deadly, not just in terms of foes or traps, but intriguing things that PCs ought not touch that they end up touching, which is sort of an old-school hallmark that DCC tries to pay a lot of attention to. I don't remember a ton about how that run went other than it was fun. There's a reason that Sailors has become kind of the standard con funnel. It provides what it says on the tin, an adventure that is relatively self-contained and lets you take low-level PCs through, perhaps killing some of them depending on how you do it, and taking it to a satisfying conclusion that then sort of opens up the potential to more adventure, right? So it's a sort of adventure where you have an ending, but that ending is open-ended, if that makes any sense whatsoever. In the more recent run for my Trident Bay group, this is with 5e, so as a lot of my adventures have been in the past couple years, taking DCC or OSR stuff and applying it to 5e, often on the fly, which sometimes creates unintended consequences, but that's what we're here for, right? You play to see what happens. Or sometimes you play to see what Eric forgot. That seems to be the case as I get older. Like, I forgot you had that spell. That changes everything. And that's okay. I like to be surprised. That's why we play. So those of you that are familiar with this adventure will be pleased to hear that when you throw a small group of, you know, I guess second and third level at the time, they were probably third at the time, third level 5e PCs at Sailors on the Starless Sea, when they get to the ending down below, and one of them has the enlarged spell to throw on somebody, that changes things a little. So you have this giant sort of kaiju effect on that ziggurat at the end, and that was pretty cool. Not even just in hindsight, like at the time, it was cool. I was like, oh, okay, we're doing that. Very well. The main aggressors in Sailors on the Starless Sea are these beastmen, these sort of Children of Chaos type thing. Harley provides us with, you know, ways to do them as varied beastmen. For the purposes of my game, I made them all into goatmen. I wanted some consistency, and I wanted to introduce this sort of goat menace thing that, again, came up later. And we'll talk about that again when we get to the next adventure where they appear. At the time when I ran it, I didn't do too much to the monsters. I let the thing in the water work the way it was supposed to, and then the goatmen, I actually kept them pretty weak. Which was neat, actually. And I don't know that it was a conscious choice. I think it was a lazy choice and also an inexperienced 5e choice. But in hindsight, I think it worked because with the goatmen having so few hit points, right, and a totally reasonable AC, in the end scene, PCs were able to kind of carve a swath of destruction through them. Like, by no means was success guaranteed, but they were able to, you know, sow their Conan oats, right, where they could sort of wade in and start chopping goats. Whereas if I had cranked up the hit points of the goatmen to be proportional, I guess is the word I'm looking for, to the level of the 5e characters and the expectations of 5e, that would have been a much more dangerous encounter. And because it would have been so deadly, I think it would have actually been less thrilling. To me, the point of the ziggurat encounter is to climb the ziggurat and do the stuff at the top. So keeping the goatmen as paper people was a good call in hindsight. So what do I like about this adventure? It's got all your classic tropes. It's got the chaos cult stuff. It's got the evil beastmen. It's got some plant monsters. It's got some traps. It's got an entire room that full of like evil cult stuff that my players didn't even get to. They're like, ooh, that door suggests we ought not go in there, so they didn't. They came back in a later session when they revisited the keep, but the first time through, they're like, no, we're not going in there. We're gonna do what we're supposed to do and get the hell out. And so that's what they did. They had a great time with it. The chaos stuff at the end is intriguing and memorable. The original cover art is great for that because you can get to that point in the adventure and be like, and then this is the dude. You pull out the cover. One thing that I do have a gripe with in general these days is that so often the cover art is not helpful. It's maybe useful in trying to sell me the adventure, but it's not useful to me at the table. But I have a whole rant about cover art and movie posters and NPCs standing around as cover art that maybe we'll cover another time. No pun intended. So, Sailors on the Starless Sea has become this standard. Lots of people run it. Some people have run it so much they run it backwards. I think Doug does that. different permutations. It's worth picking up. It's what, like $10 or whatever? Probably slightly less than PDF. I haven't paid attention to the disparity there. It's worth having in your go bag because it's so straightforward and so kind of, despite multiple entrances to one section, it is a linear adventure. Let's not kid ourselves. But that's what makes it efficient for con use or short time use. A lot of people have gotten to the point where they think that, oh, all DCC adventures have to be good for cons, and they're all meant to be run in 4 hours. And I'm sorry, that is a bushel basket of crap. Most of them are not designed to be run in 4 hours. But the ones that can be run in 4 hours are nice and tightly written, and one of those is Sailors on the Starless Sea. So this is a strong recommend for me. If you haven't already played it to death or run it to death, whatever system you're running, whether it's DCC, an OSR system, or 5e or something else, think about picking up this adventure as something to read through and really grok and keep in your con bag. Because once you've run it once, you could probably run it from memory. Because, and I say this as a compliment to Harley, there's not that much to it. One thing very naturally leads to the next in the adventure. And so it the PCs propel themselves forward through the adventure without too much nonsense going on. So again, strong recommend for Sailors on the Starless Sea. Now, let's compare that to Doom of the Savage Kings, which is an adventure that I also liked and also recommend, but it's a very different kind of adventure. So Doom is also by Harley Stroh, and it's got that same DCC vibe in the sense that we're dealing with things man was not meant to know, the magic is rare and powerful, and there's all this kind of stuff going on. It's an homage to Beowulf, if you haven't figured that out from the cover copy. So you definitely have that sort of Viking vibe. You could easily transport it somewhere else. So I've only run it once. I ran it in my current game, the current iteration of the Trident Bay 5e campaign. And it took 2 sessions. And I say that not to excoriate the adventure. There's a decent amount of content in this adventure. I've seen people attempt to run Doom of the Savage Kings in a 4-hour con session. I'm not sure how they do it. I'm not sure what they cut out. Obviously, something has to be cut out. In fact, when I go to this con this weekend, it is being run at another table as a 4-hour session, so I'm going to very much try to overhear and see what gets dropped. Because there's a lot of stuff in the module. Basically, the gimmick is that this village is being menaced by this otherworldly hound demon thing, and the central gimmick of the adventure is that you can't just kill the hound. You could kill the hound, but it's going to come back unless you do it a certain way. So the adventure becomes more about getting the things you need in order to make sure that you can kill the hound permanently. And even killing it once is not necessarily an easy thing. I haven't played through this adventure in DCC, so I would love to hear from somebody who has done so or has run it in DCC to talk about the difficulty level of the hound. Because I ended up sort of looking at the hound stats and looking at some 5e monsters that looked very similar, because I'm on a kick now where I'm trying to actually translate rather than wing it, because I've been burned a couple times trying to wing it. I think I'm old enough now that, yeah, I went through this phase where I'm like, I'm super smart, I can do this. And now I'm old enough where I say, I'm not that smart. I need to actually do a little prep on some of these things so that I don't disappoint myself, let alone my players. So anyway, I picked a monster of suitable challenge rating and did a couple little tweaks and used that. And I think it worked out fine. In the case of our campaign, the PCs went in and after they discovered the problem and all this, and there's plenty of NPCs to talk to in this adventure. They went out and they tried to kill the hound, and they did kill the hound. They're like, yay, we killed the hound. And it very quickly became apparent that they had not killed the hound because they hadn't done any research at all. And it's funny because, this was a group of guys who are almost all experienced old school players, but many of them hadn't played in ages. So they were so excited to go, do D&D stuff that they sort of mentally skipped over the entire, maybe we should canvass the town for rumors type standard operating procedure. So they're like, oh, where's the thing? Let's go kill it. And indeed they did. It was a hard fight, but they killed it. And then they were kind of blown away that, oh no, we didn't kill it. Anyway, so really the heart of the adventure is talking to the different NPCs in town, figuring out what's going on with the Jarl. There's a witch in town who can help you out. She's a fascinating NPC and amazing things can happen with her. I was super pleased that, you know, one of my PCs took the bait and essentially, you know, it's written so that if you want help from the witch to deal with the hound, someone has to promise to marry the witch, right? They say crone, they don't call her a witch, but she's obviously a witch. And one of my players bit, and they're like, let's do that. It was made far more funny because the character in question is a centaur. So you can imagine the 10 minutes of like table jokes about the witch marrying the centaur. Yeah, I'll let you play that out in your head. So anyway, that's there. And what's really cool about that is because we're trying to do this Beowulf homage, it's great that Harley includes the witch in there because you have this sort of fairy tale solution to a fantasy problem. And that's something that I've advocated for years, especially in my Wampus Country days, in that, you know, stabbing something in the face ought not suffice in a magical world. So here, in the case of the hound, we have the option to make this fairy tale bargain that doesn't sound great with this witch in order to get the magical MacGuffin that you need to bind the hound, or I should say and or, because my players did both, or you can go to the tomb of the aforementioned savage kings and sort of quest for their artifacts of old that ought to have, according to rumor, the ability to permanently slay the beast. So that's what my PCs did. They made the deal with the witch, and then they also went to the tomb and extracted the stuff from there, and then they re-engaged the hound for the second time. And, of course, we're successful because, you know, that you've got enough people and you've got all your MacGuffins. It was still a hard fight, though. I think I made the right choice as far as picking 5e monsters that would threaten this group. And the group has slowly gotten larger, so that's been a challenge for me. It's one thing to have 4 5e PCs. It's another to have 6 or 7 or potentially 8. That's a whole different deal. You know, I know a lot of my listeners like me have a lot of time under their belts running for large AD&D groups at, you know, low or even mid levels. I think it's a slightly different dynamic for 5e because of the robustness of the PCs and the amount of just damage and bizarre stuff that they potentially can throw out. So that's been a learning curve for me, an adjustment, and that's fine. I want to learn those things as we go, but I'm starting to get this big group. So anyway, the group was successful, and then they came back to the village to talk to the Jarl, and there's this whole subplot about, you know, is the Jarl an asshole, all this kind of stuff. And my PCs talked to him, and they basically decided that they don't like him, and the day may come when they have to whack him, but they didn't want to do it today. So as we move forward in the campaign, and this was the most recent session last month, they're going to use the village as their sort of home base for now, but they've got this Jarl who pretty much doesn't like them and sees them as a threat to his power base. So I think we're going to have more come out of that as we go forward. The bottom line is, Doom of the Savage Kings is a great adventure. It's worth picking up to use or to mine for ideas or just to see the structure therein. I don't think you can do it in one... I mean, maybe you can. One long session, maybe you could, depending on the pacing at the table and how your PCs work. I was perfectly content to break it up into two sessions, but also understand that we've been scheduling 5 to 6 hour sessions that turn out to be more like 4 to 5 hour sessions because nobody ever gets there on time, and we start a little late, and then there's a food break. You know how this goes. So just be prepared when you run it to have pacing points where you can stop halfway if that's possible for you, or just drop it on the map and see if they ever show up. So as we move forward from that, I will see what they want to do next time. One of the things on my agenda to do this weekend after the con is to send out to our group, we have a Facebook group for the game, a couple options for what players want to do next. We're still in the early stages of this campaign, so I'm doing a lot of hand-holding. I don't say that to imply that like they don't know what they're doing, but we're not quite to the point where the players feel sufficient agency to come to me and say, hey, what's this on the map? I want to go there. We're not quite there yet. The last couple sessions have been, here's what's happening, and now we're transitioning to, here's a couple things that could happen. Y'all pick one, right? And then from that, I think we'll be suitably invested with some storylines and things interacting with their backgrounds and whatever, that they have things they want to quest for. So to return to looking at these two adventures, Sailors on the Starless Sea and Doom of the Savage Kings are very different adventures. One, Sailors is pulp, sword and sorcery, one-shot, con adventure, linear, whereas Doom of the Savage Kings is epic, legendary, fairy tale-ish. Probably not one session, if you run like I do. A little more open. It'll go great on your hex map, but understand that there are implicit things that go with that. Whereas sailors, all you need is an area where it makes sense to have an old chaos, you know, keep that's fallen into abandon. So I recommend them both. Harley is pretty solid. I have other Harley adventures on my shelf that will probably get run eventually. And we'll compare them then. I think it's important when you're doing reviews to talk about not only how they worked in play, but, you know, the through lines you can see either from a product line or a company or, in this case, an author. So that's that. I don't know if I would run either of these adventures again. I mean, maybe as a con game. I guess I'd run Sailors as a con game, but it seems like everybody and their brother has run it as a con game. I think I'd rather run something just different. So I didn't feel like I was doing the same stuff over and over. But maybe in a later episode, we'll talk about other DCC adventures that I think are suitable as con slot games. That's probably a reasonable thing to talk about.